News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you listen to the program regularly, you know that each week we visit with veterans of World War II, and the idea is pretty straightforward, pretty simple. We want to honor them for their service and for their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, and along the way learn a thing or two ourselves about how to love our country. We call it Hometown Heroes because no matter where you live, no matter where your hometown is in this great country of ours, there are heroes around you, and you probably don't realize it. In this case, if you were down at a car dealership in Kern County the last few years looking for parts, you might not have known that the guy behind the counter was a veteran of the Battle of Iwo Jima, part of the 5th Marine Division that provided the spearhead for that crucial point in the Pacific War. Our guest today, 86-year-old Umbert Cantelmi of Bakersfield, California. Although back in 1941, you would have called the beautiful city of Delano your hometown. Do you remember where you were on December 7th, 1941, and how you heard that America was at war?
I was in high school. I think I was a sophomore. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a sophomore when I heard it. It was 1941, I believe, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. So that's where I heard it. And then, of course, my brother was in the service already in the Army. Mm-hmm. He was in the artillery training for the Europe. But that's how I remember. And also, let's see, my other brother was in the Navy at that time.
So was this a big shock to your system to hear that all of a sudden the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor and America was at war?
Oh, yeah. I think everybody was shocked at that time.
Was there, I know a lot of people have told me if they were in their high school years, and many were, that there was a big assembly. Everyone got called into the gym or whatever and was told about the news or even listened to the president's speech that way. Do you remember anything like that?
I remember some of the President Roosevelt's speech, but I don't know where I was at the time, but I don't know whether I heard it at school or in my own radio or whatever.
Did it register at that time that this might impact your life personally, or were you more concerned about your brother who was already in the service?
Well, I was concerned about my brother, but I didn't know it was going to last that long, so it kind of slipped in the back of my mind that I wouldn't, be called. So, but then the war kept going.
And how did you end up as a U.S. Marine? Was that a decision of yours, or did someone else make that decision for you?
Someone else made that decision. I had to stay home. My two brothers were gone, and my folks, they'd rented an additional 30 acres. They had 10 to raise watermelons, and so I stayed there for probably about a year. Mm-hmm. And then I was called. I stayed there to help them, of course, and because they were from old country, and they needed I needed to do things for them in English because they didn't speak very well.
They only spoke Italian, and had to be the translator.
Oh yes, and then of course my dad mentioned. I mean, he eventually got speaking pretty good. I mean, fair. I mean, you understand him in English then. Mm-hmm. But my mother, she stayed home all the time. She didn't speak as well. Then I was called, there was probably 8 or 9 of us from Delano that were called, and one of them included was my cousin. Now, he had a brother in the Navy at the time, and he was killed off of Okinawa in the Navy, the suicide plane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, kamikaze, they call him again.
Yep.
And there was only, I think he was on a destroyer, and only four survivors. Of course, he was down below in the engine room, and the concussion killed him down there.
I'm curious, when you were drafted and you know that you're going to go in, and there are a lot of stereotypes in the world, and there are always exceptions to the stereotype, but I married into an Italian-American family, and I know there's a stereotype about Italian mothers being very protective of their children.
They are.
You had two brothers who were already in the service. Was it hard for your mother to let you go?
No, I'm sure it was. Yes, I'm sure it was.
Was that a tearful goodbye at home?
Yeah, it was terrible, but they had to be done, so I went. And the group, these 8 or 10 guys from Delano that were going down to the L.A. Recruitment Center, mm-hmm. they bussed us down there, and they asked what branch I wanted, and of course, my brother was Navy, and I says, Navy. And so they stamped Naval Forces. Well, the Marines are part of the Naval Forces. So all of us were picked from Delano to go into the Marines at mm-hmm. that time.
How did that sit with you?
Well, you know, I've seen a few movies of the Marines and in their jungle warfare and stuff. And I says, well, I guess it's got to be.
Because at this point, you say you'd seen a couple movies. You'd probably heard about some of the early battles in the Pacific,
right.
like Tarawa, where there were pretty bad losses.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There was started from Guadalcanal up to mm-hmm. up the line. Saipan is one. Guam.
Saipan and Tinian.
Marshall Islands.
So you knew that you were going to be potentially in some serious danger when you accepted an assignment with the U.S. Marine Corps.
Yes, I knew that.
What would you say was your welcome to the Marines moment? When did you realize, hey, this is going to be pretty tough. I'm going to have to work pretty hard here just to get in shape and follow these orders and do what they want me to do.
Well, you had no choice when you got in boot camp. You had to do what the drill instructors told you. So they that's where you get your discipline and other important factors for the Marines.
Did you have any idea of what your brothers were up to? Did you hear from them at all? Have any contact with them?
There's times that we didn't hear from at all, and when we did, when I was there, the letters were censored. They would cut out a lot of information out of the letters. And my sister was home, and she would she was married, but she would get letters, and they were all censored. And, of course, my mother and father didn't read English, so my sister got the mail most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it there.
Well, tell me about the buildup to getting shipped overseas and maybe what was going through your mind, what you expected to happen, and how that ended up being in contrast to what actually happened, because it's never the same thing.
Well, I knew it was Marines, so I knew it was going to be tough. So I just went in and figured I had to do it, and that's the only thing. And then after a while, you just become a proud Marine after you train so long.
Were the guys that trained you older Marine veterans who had been in for a while?
Yes, some are staff sergeants, but they had to be treated like officers because even though they were non-commissioned officers, because that's where you get your discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with marching and all other things that we had to basic taught.
Did they try to convince you that you were special, that you were more than just a soldier, that being a Marine meant more than that?
Yes, they did. The DIs would do that, yes.
Did you buy it?
Well, eventually I did.
Once you proved it to yourself, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you had, at this point, you had never heard about a little island called Iwo Jima. Who in the world outside of that neck of the Pacific really had. Do you remember the first time you heard we're headed to Iwo Jima?
The first time I heard of it was when we were going there. Mm-hmm. It was on board ship. They had a replica of the island, and that's where I first heard it.
And how did they break that to you in terms of the expectations they laid out for you, how they anticipated the battle to go?
Cause well, they first thought it would only be about a 3 or 4 day operation. And they thought they bombed the island for a long time, maybe 3 months, heavy bombers. And then the battleships bombarded it. And they had cruisers at that time, too. They were firing at it. And the planes, big the 29s, B-29s, or one of the big planes were bombing at least 3 or 4 times a week.
Yeah, they dropped a ton of ammunition and artillery on that island.
And they still didn't hurt those caves.
Well, and that's the thing. The upper echelon believed at the time that the amount of shelling they had done there, that not much could survive that. But boy, were they wrong.
They were wrong, yes.
And you, at the time, you were in a replacement outfit?
I was in a replacement, and I was aboard ship, though, when the initial landing. That was on February 19th, mm-hmm. 1945, and I went in on the 20th in the morning, 8 or 9 o'clock, I think, 9:10, somewhere in there, on an Amtrak. We all, a bunch of us all went into on the island because we had to start doing the unloading and until we were called. And then the casualties got so heavy after 4 or 5 days, we were all placed into the different, most of us went into the 5th Marine Division.
Well, and I imagine, I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes and imagine what would have been going through your mind at the time. If they gather you on the ship and they show you a little mock-up of this island that's not very big, has a big mountain on one end of it and a couple airfields, and they say it's going to be over in 3 or 4 days, and you're in a replacement outfit, you probably aren't anticipating too vicious a battle, right?
That's true.
So you didn't expect to be in the thick of it like you were.
Right. Correct.
When you did go ashore the second day after the initial landing, the day after the battle started in February of 1945. What did you see as you got onto that beach?
Well, I'll tell you, I thought I was in a nightmare because shells were falling all over, artillery and mortars and everything. And if you didn't get down, you would probably be chewed up with the mortar shells, you know. And there were so many that were killed that way with the mortars.
And probably killed not too far from you, on your left and on your right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was bodies that were just dead Marines piled up for removal, you know, I don't know, for burial, I guess. And then a lot of the guys were, you know, I don't know what they say. They said the first 72 hours, there was 2 out of 3 were hit, either wounded or killed.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't put you in very good odds.
No.
And how did you handle that? Because this is your first taste of combat. You haven't been in any other battles. You're 19 years old. You've never faced anything like this. And all of a sudden, there are guys on your left, guys on your right, guys in front of you who are dead. And you have to be thinking, I'm next, don't you?
Well, you wonder when it's going to be. You mean it might be any time. So I just happened to be moving at the spot that at the time... moved at the time that the mortar dropped where I was standing or moving along. And like one time that the Japanese would launch these big rockets. They were rockets. They think they put them on. They had no accuracy, but they landed on somewhere on the island, and they had to kill somebody. So we were moving forward, and we're setting up for the night. And... We have these demolition guys. They come ahead of us and set these trip flares. So they hit these trip flares, and then you can see them silhouetted. But anyway, my squad leader said, just settle in this shell hole here. And he was going to, I think he said he was going to come in with me, but till he got his squad set up. And then he come by and says, you better move out of it because someone else is coming here. There was a little knoll in the back, about 50 feet or so, or I don't know. And I started digging the foxhole there, and I was about probably knee deep, about ready to, you know, you don't dig very far. You just got to get covered.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those rockets landed right in the hole. I was just left. So, and there's other, you know, close calls. I'd look back, and I had to watch a cave one time as they were moving forward, and see if any, you know, the enemy coming out of the caves or the watch. And after a while, they were getting up there a little way, so I decided I had to get up with them. So, just as I was out of range of the, I looked back and a mortar landed right there. So I just, it just happened to be, I guess the Lord was with me. I'm sure he was.
And I know you have lots of close calls that you can tell us about and lots of experiences there on Iwo Jima. and certainly since then. Right now, we're going to take our first commercial break. When we come back, we'll explore more of Umbert Cantelmi's experiences with the 5th Marine Division. They provided the spearhead, that initial invasion force on Iwo Jima, suffering great casualties. Fortunately, he was not one of them. He's here to tell us about it today, and we'll get the rest of his story when Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Today we're visiting with another one of those Semper Fi guys, a U.S. Marine Corps veteran of World War II on a battle that made Marines famous, the Battle of Iwo Jima. He was on the shore the second day of that battle as a replacement with the 5th Marine Division, a division that suffered intense casualties in that battle, so many killed. Just in the initial days of that landing, thousands of Americans would lose their lives fighting the Japanese on an island that had been bombed and bombed and bombed. You talked about the tunnels. You made reference to the tunnels, the network of caves that the Japanese had there. I'm guessing when you went ashore, you had no idea about that. You'd never heard of these tunnels before.
I've never heard of the tunnels before.
So not only are you facing this fire that you've never encountered before, that you're getting practically blown out of foxholes and seeing other guys killed left and right, you don't even know what you're up against. You don't know what's hidden on this island.
No, I didn't. I didn't at the time.
Yeah. When you think about that now, because you didn't know what you were up against then, but when you look back now and you know the history of that battle and the way the Japanese were prepared and were dug in, is it amazing to you that you survived? Is it amazing that it ended up with an Allied victory?
Yes, it is. It's amazing that anybody lived through that.
Now, we talked about what you encountered and what it was like for you your first day on Iwo Jima. I don't know if we talked about whether or not you were actually to perform any of the functions you were hoping to perform there. What were the duties that you were trying to carry out? Because there's always an objective for each day. And were you able to actually do that?
Well, it was just a normal duties that we would advance forward, and then when the fire got so, the mortars and artillery got so heavy, we'd have to dig in, and it just happened that way. Then there was pillboxes, but I never, that guys had to, depend on where they were, but they had to be knocked out, and then of course flamethrower guys would come up and throw that flame in there, and they all, and but on my side there, I didn't, I just went with the as we moved forward, and we threw grenades. And
sounds like you were spending a lot of time on your belly or in a hole,
right?
Not too much on 2 feet.
Well, we had to do 2 feet too, because we had to get to the north end
eventually.
Yes. So that I think it was, they said 26 days, but it was 36 days when I started. We moved down to the taken over. And like I was saying that we come down, I didn't say it yet, but we came down from the north end and dug in on the side of the into the sand for that evening, and the planes were coming in, some of the planes that needed that were crippled, they were already been flying in.
Because the runway had been taken by American forces, so it was safe for them to land there.
Right. They would, they had repaired the runways, and they were coming in. Well, this was a hearsay, but the airmen, there was a group of airmen, they slept in tents above ground, and we were dug in, waiting for our ship to take us back to Hawaii. They come during the night to the Japanese, and they cut all their throats, and we heard that on the.
I've heard a lot of stories like that. Mm-hmm. And so when something like that happens, you're thankful that you were where you were and not where they were, but it probably also says, hey, are we safe where we are either?
Right. Correct.
I can't imagine what you're going through. I want to paint a more complete picture for the folks at home of what it was like for you as a Marine there with the 5th Marine Division. What were you carrying? How were you equipped for battle? You had a pack on your back that probably weighed 50 or 60 pounds?
About a 60-pound pack. And we had our folding little shovel that we carried. It pretty hard to dig a hole with it, but it worked. And We had grenades on our side here, and we had ammunition belts and M1.
Mm-hmm. And you were carrying something else besides the weaponry and the shovel, something your sister sent you from home in Delano?
Yes. It was a medal of the Sacred Heart of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. And what'd you do with that?
Well, I wrapped it around my neck, and I have a lot of faith in it. I think that brought me through it.
And, you know, everybody can hear a story like that, and they say, oh, it's a good luck charm. Oh, it's, you know, it's a nice idea. It sounds like it was more than that to you.
It was.
Uh-huh. There was some meaning there.
It is, and I'm still wearing it, you know.
You're wearing it right now as we're talking.
Yes.
And we're going to put a picture of that online at kmjnow.com, where you can also see the way our guest today, Umbert Cantelmi, looked as a 19-year-old Marine in his full-dress uniform. Not quite cracking a smile, looking serious enough to be a Marine, but we'll put that picture online for you as well. You're from a Roman Catholic family.
Yes.
An Italian-American family, and it sounds like that faith was a big part of your life and part of why you believe that you and your other brothers came home from the war.
That's true, yes. Because my cousin, he had two children. She was my first cousin. The boys were my second cousin, but she only had the two children, and she lost one. And there was three of us in combat at the same time in combat area.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God we all came back.
And you knew your mother was back home praying for you.
Oh, yes.
What about you? Was that something that when you're in a battle like that where it's hard to sleep at night because you don't know if the Japanese are going to make a nighttime raid on you, where there's tunnels and caves everywhere, you don't know when you're going to be shot or killed, do you even have time to say a prayer here and there?
Oh, you always said prayer.
Yeah?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we had the their priest when we had that mass one time, I don't know, it was about 2 weeks or 2.5 weeks after then we were able to get in the safe area. We had mass, and he said, "Now you got to promise yourselves if you come out of this alive, you will go to church every Sunday." So, you know, everybody did that. I'm sure I did.
That's an opportunistic priest, isn't it?
Right. So, for a while when I got back, I didn't go to church, and then I had to sponsor one of my friends wanted me to sponsor their daughter for in baptism.
Uh-huh.
So I decided I better go to confession and get myself back to church because I promised God, and you promise God, you're that's serious. So from then on, I tried to go to church every Sunday.
And that you mentioned that, and I'm sure, chronologically speaking, we're bouncing here and there in terms of the Battle of Iwo Jima, but it seems to me that that would be a very interesting contrast and seem a little out of place to be experiencing a Catholic Mass on the island of Iwo Jima after everything that you've seen and experienced on that island. That seems like a surreal experience.
Yes. They also had Protestant services.
Yep. Was that kind of like hitting the reset button for you, or letting you know that you've gotten through a good portion of it? I mean, what did that mean to you at that time?
Well,
it seems symbolic.
It mean that meant that I had to go back there and pray so I could come out of it alive.
Uh-huh. Well, it worked. And we'll put a photo of that, too, on our website at kmjnow.com. Mr. Cantelmi still has a photo of all the Catholic soldiers participating in Mass on the sands of Iwo Jima back in 1945. Let's talk about some more of the things that you witnessed and experienced on that island. Everybody who was on Iwo Jima or near Iwo Jima in February and March of 1945 seems to have a story about the flag. And there is no image from World War II that's been seen more than the raising of the flag atop Mount Suribachi. But that image we all know is the second flag that was on top of that mountain.
Correct. The first one was so small.
And you saw the first one.
Well, maybe I saw the big one, but I when I looked up the first time, and the flag was there, so I may have been the first one.
And where were you at the time? How did you find out someone say, hey, look over there?
I was in the somewhere pretty close because the 20th Marines took the.
They made the ascent up Suribachi.
They sent up the Suribachi and took it, so I hadn't, mm-hmm. I hadn't been too far away. So it was down maybe 500 yards or 1,000 yards away from it.
And did someone say something, or you just noticed it?
I think someone mentioned it, and I just, we looked up, and we saw the flag up there on Suribachi, and that gave us a boost.
That meant something. It wasn't just, oh, wow, that's nice. It was, hey, we're doing something here.
Right, correct.
I mean, was that a real impact for you? Was it like, you know, someone giving you a shot in the arm? How big of an impact did it have?
I would say so. It was a big impact because we knew that it had been taken, and that was one of the tough. One of those Marines that went up that Suribachi had it tough because they were all entrenched. The Japanese had caves in there, and they had I think they even had artillery and machine guns, they were connected with the main island because they had a tunnel from the Suribachi down to the mainland. So they were, and so it took them, they had to use flamethrowers and everything to get to the top of that Suribachi, and they had it rough. They really did. Probably a lot more than I did.
Well, and so you saw the flag flying there initially, and since then I'm sure you've seen the famous Rosenthal picture of it millions of times. You've seen pictures, maybe even been to the Marine Corps Memorial in Washington, D.C., with a huge bronze statue of that scene. When you see that image today of the Marines raising the flag atop Mount Suribachi, what does it mean to you? What does it do to you? Does that have a powerful impact on you, and does it move you still today?
Oh, yes, it still moves me. In fact, I've ordered some of the statuettes for the showing the raising of the flag on Suribachi, and I got one for each one of my children. So it did.
So if you're thumbing through a magazine today, and you see that, what do you think of? What does that make you think of guys you served with? Does it remind you of guys who are still buried there? I mean, what does it make you think of now, just to look at that image?
I just thank God that it was completed and taken over, because that's what was the main reason why they were able to bomb Japan and have it surrender.
Mm-hmm.
B-29s, and they were more accurate. And in fact, when we occupied after Iwo, we went to back to the 5th Marine Corps base, which was on Hawaii, the large island. We had a plateau up there, and camp was called Camp Tarawa.
Mm-hmm.
We had it easy for the first month. They let us sleep and have breakfast until noon. And then after 1 month, that was it, because we had gone day and night because Japan was needed to be taken. We trained, we'd have the night, they'd call us out anytime, and we'd travel through. Hawaii had a lot of different terrain, so we had to train rigorously. I mean, this was just constant. And then Truman dropped the bomb, and well, it was the second one, I guess, when they surrendered, and the war was over, and we went back. They took us on board the troop ships, and we went to occupy. We went to the same area as where we would have landed. It was near the Sasebo Naval Base, Sasebo, the lower part of Japan.
Let me ask you about when you found out, though, that the war was indeed over. Because here you are, you're, as you say, training vigorously to prepare to invade Japan. You've already seen the enemy on Iwo Jima. You know how they fight to the death. You mm-hmm. know what they'll do, how they'll go to any lengths to try to kill you. And I'm sure you were not relishing the opportunity to go make a landing on mainland Japan, where they're going to fight even more furiously. So when you found out that the war was over, that you wouldn't be going over there to fight, what did that mean to you?
Well, we knew it would have been tough, and probably wouldn't make it, because when we occupied, we went, like I say, we went to the same area that we were to invade, and the there was a large level area, like a large beach or something, and a flat plateau, and then behind it, quarter mile or something, there was these mountains, and they were all gun emplacements in them, and so they would have just been shot down from. So I don't know. They said that it was going to be would have been a lot of casualties between the Americans and the Japanese. I mean, I think around 1 million. They said.
Yeah, the official American government estimates were that more than 1 million Americans would be killed in the invasion of Japan. And I've talked to a lot of veterans who believe that the atomic bomb saved their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And for you, it sounds like this isn't just, yeah, I think it saved my life. You actually went ashore where you would have gone ashore and saw the very spots where they would have been able to just pick you off one by one.
Oh, yeah. They could weld them, you know, or artillery and mortars to pieces, yeah.
So there's no doubt in your mind that the bomb saved your life.
Oh, yes. I feel like that I wouldn't have made it if we had invaded Japan.
And what kinds of things, how long were you there in occupation forces, and what kinds of things did you do there?
I was there 10 months, I believe, 10 months. And we were the first ones in, and nobody was there but us. And, of course, that the Japanese were real good. They did everything that they were told. They piled up their Samurai swords, rifles, and everything in a big heaping pile all over the place. And they saluted us. And after that, they started getting Americanized. So they started these dance places for the men. And
mm-hmm. Sounds like you're about ready to come home.
I was ready.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to talk about that when we come back. We'll come down the home stretch of Hometown Heroes straight ahead with Umbert Cantelmi, a Marine Corps veteran of World War II, a survivor of Iwo Jima. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We still have a few minutes left with Umbert Cantelmi, 86 years old of Bakersfield, California, a Marine Corps veteran of World War II, served with the 5th Marine Division. And if you know your World War II history, you know the 5th Marines played a huge role on Iwo Jima. They provided the spearhead, that initial invasion force to take that island with heavy casualties against a dug-in Japanese opponent. And maybe you might remember this gentleman. Maybe you had a car, you needed some parts, you went to Jim Burke Ford in Bakersfield and saw a big old picture of the flag raising on Mount Suribachi on the wall and said, well, that's neat. And maybe our guest today, Umbert Cantelmi, even told you that he was there on Iwo Jima, saw the flag atop Mount Suribachi, and saw a whole lot more than that. When we left off, he was talking about being part of the occupation forces in Japan after the war had officially ended. Then after about 10 months there, you finally have enough points to come home. Your brothers are already home. I bet your mama was happy to see you.
Oh, yeah. Sure, they were. They were happy. Yeah, sure, they were. Yes, they were.
Do you remember getting back home and what that reception was like, what that moment was like emotionally for you?
Just other than they were happy mm-hmm. for me to be back, that's all.
Did it take you a while to get used to civilian life again after that time in the military?
Yeah, I kind of hit. It didn't take me too long. When I got home, I went in partnership with my cousin on a restaurant, but that didn't last long. I was about 6 weeks, and he took off and got married. And so when he come back, I says, he's gone about 2 weeks. And I says, well, you know, you can have it. So I let him have the restaurant, and then I got the job at the Ford dealership in Delano. At that time, it was George Haberfeld Incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I started my parts career, and then become the Jerry O'Brien was parts manager, and he was been there for years, and he was new his stuff, and he taught me, and he passed away, and then I become the parts manager there. And when it closed down, I moved. I drove back and forth for a long time to Jim Burke Ford in Bakersfield.
Mm-hmm.
And
and you see your brothers get married, your cousin get married. You eventually decided to have a family of your own. How many children and grandchildren do you have?
I have 3 children, and I have 5 grandchildren.
And I know the people who listen to this program hear this a lot, and they might get sick of me talking about it, but I have to point it out. They never would have been born if you didn't make it home from Iwo Jima.
Yeah, that's probably, yes.
And you came close to not coming home.
Several times, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You ever think about that? You ever think how different things could have been?
Well, no. I try to not remember those things. I want to forget them.
Well, I understand that while you were there, and maybe it was on more than one occasion, but while you were on Iwo Jima, you had the opportunity to visit the makeshift cemetery for the 5th Marine Division?
I visited. I'd seen it, all the crosses over there under near Suribachi. Right, yes.
For people who, well, very few people listening were there or have been there, maybe some folks have seen a picture of all the white crosses in the sand, but for people that weren't there, have never seen it, how would you describe that scene and what it did to you to stand there and think about it and think about what those crosses represented?
Just a bunch of brave heroes, that's all I can tell you. I mean, they were all Americans and they fought gallantly.
Probably a lot of guys that you knew and served with that are buried.
Yeah, there's
there.
Probably some. Yeah, sure.
And I think I made reference to this earlier, but the fact that the scene from Iwo Jima is now the Marine Corps Memorial, that for all the Marine Corps veterans, the image that symbolizes their efforts in World War II and every war is from a battle that you took part in. Does that mean something to you? Does that give you pride to know that your battle stands out?
Oh, yes, it gives me pride. Yeah, it sure does.
Have you been there?
To Iwo Jima?
To the statue in Arlington?
Oh, no, I haven't been there, no. And I had a chance to go to Iwo Jima once to visit in 1995, but I didn't take the offer. But I didn't ever go to the memorial.
Well, if you ever get the chance, and I'm sure you've seen the pictures and you probably know this already, but the quote that is inscribed on that memorial, which is larger than life at Arlington National Cemetery, is from Admiral Chester Nimitz, and it says, "Among the Marines in the Pacific, uncommon valor was a common virtue." Have you heard that quote before?
I heard that quote before, yes.
What does that mean to you?
Well, I'm just kind of proud of it, that's all.
It means you're one tough son of a gun.
No, doesn't mean that at all.
I mean, is that what you saw, the guys that you served with? Is that, I know that's a kind of a flowery way to say that these guys had guts, these guys were courageous, these guys didn't care about themselves, but is that what you saw there?
Yes, sure.
Is there maybe one thing that you witnessed, maybe even something you did yourself or a guy in your unit did, that you said, man, that's bravery, that's impressive, that's what we're here for?
I know of a Marine, his name is Sergeant Barcelone,
mm-hmm.
And he was a true patriot fighter. He received the Medal of Honor in one of the islands, and they offered for him to go to U.S. to sell bonds. He refused. He said he has to be with his buddies, and then he was, I don't know how long after he was landing, but several days, 3, 4, 5 days, he was mortally wounded.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, he was a hero. That was a hero.
That's the epitome of a Marine to you. Well, and I think it's fitting that now when, if people ever go by the signature Marine Corps base on the West Coast, Camp Pendleton near San Diego, as they drive that stretch of I-5, that is the John Barcelone Freeway, named after the man that you just mentioned.
Where's that at?
Right by Camp Pendleton.
Oh, really? I haven't been down there.
That's true. Take a trip. Go cool off from the valley heat. We know your car's running after all your years working in parts.
Yeah.
Anything else from Iwo Jima that you think our listeners ought to know, people that weren't there should know about what it was like to spend over a month on that island, aside from maybe even the combat? Could you sleep at night?
Well, no, you couldn't hardly sleep. There was too much going on. Yeah. Another thing, we didn't have any change of clothes except for socks every now and then. And in other words, we wore the same thing for the whole We did. I don't know if others did or not, but our unit didn't get any clothes. So we wore those clothes for all the length of time, 30-some days, 36 days.
You guys didn't smell like garlic and basil and oregano, I'm sure.
Well, I'll tell you, when we got aboard ship on the transport, when they ferried us out there to go back to Hawaii, there was a big pile of clothes, and I said, you had to have a gas mask to stay in there.
What'd they do with them?
They burned them. I think they put them in the
furnace. They just torched them.
Yeah.
Yeah, they probably didn't want to throw them in the ocean. It might have killed all the fish. And it's fun to joke about it now. I'm sure it wasn't too pleasant at the time. And I know that at one point you felt something on your arm and pulled up your sleeve and found some blood. You had a small shrapnel wound. Any other close calls that you remember where, you know, you've talked about a couple times the shell landing where you just left. Mm-hmm. Any experience with any of the caves and tunnels on that island?
No.
We've heard stories of booby traps.
Well, there was booby traps, but the flamethrower, either the tanks, they would be directed. They could come up so far, the flamethrowing tanks, and they would, you could see that flame going, just napalming.
Mm-hmm.
Go in big, long arcs into the caves. And then we had these Marines, they were flamethrowers. They had a tank on their back, and they were heroes too, because they had to go places where it was dangerous, and they would be the ones that the Japanese would want to pick off. So they would be at the cave sites or close to it where they can get that fire in there. That's the only way you could get them out of the caves.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there are any misconceptions about Iwo Jima? Have you ever heard someone say something about it? You say, oh, no, that's not right. That's not what I experienced.
No, I haven't heard anything like that.
Well, in your mind, what was the most significant thing that happened there? What gives you pride when you think back on what you and all those other Marines did there?
Well, I felt real great when I was marching back from the north end. It was over with, secured, and we marched back down to the beach to get aboard ship. I felt great then.
Mm-hmm.
Felt like we'd accomplished something.
Did you ever have if you spent 36 days there, did you ever have a day where you thought, you know what, I don't know if I'm going to wake up tomorrow. I don't know if I'm going to make it through this day.
Well, you know, the person never thinks that. He thinks it's going to be the other guy. And so when it comes, it just comes. You don't know about it.
Do you think there was anything in particular that helped you survive as opposed to somebody else? Do you think there's a reason for any of that?
No, just being under the arms of Christ, that's all.
That works. It certainly worked for you. You've got a couple of your grandkids in the room here with you. Been listening to you talk all this time. And when they're your age, a lot of people won't even know what World War II is, perhaps.
Probably not.
There certainly won't be any of them around who lived through it.
They're almost forgotten now.
Well, here's your opportunity. They're in the room. Usually I pose this hypothetical, but they're actually here. So with them listening, when they say, what was World War II about? What were you guys doing? Why was it important? And why did America get involved? How do you answer them about why it was so important to do what you did?
Well, because the Japanese had come over with their carriers and planes and bombed Pearl Harbor, and they killed a lot of Americans then. And so that's when the President Roosevelt declared war on them. And so it started from there.
Did you think that everyone had the same mentality? The guys that you served with, did you feel like you guys were all fighting for the same thing or of the same mind?
I didn't. I don't know. No, I don't know about that.
Too busy trying to survive.
But there's a lot of proud Marines, I could tell you that.
Well, when you hear the Marine Corps song now.
Yeah, it pricks me up.
It gets your attention, huh?
Yeah.
Do you kind of stop in your tracks?
Yes.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to share with us about what you did in World War II or anything you witnessed or experienced?
Yeah, I think that's about it. I can't think of anything else right now.
What are you most proud of?
I'm proud that we become the victors of that island.
You certainly did that. Well, on behalf of everybody listening today, I want to say thank you for serving our country. And I know it's never easy to talk about it, so thank you for having the courage to do that, too. That is Umbert Cantelmi. He's been our guest today, Marine Corps veteran of World War II. If you missed any part of the interview, you can catch it later at kmjnow.com. All our podcasts are up there. And don't forget to go there to see some pictures of this good-looking young Marine as well, and some other photos relating to his service. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.